Thanks for tuning in. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with translator K210DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
Some of the hardest and most painful things that I've ever experienced, they're not like the fatigue that builds up over 20 days racing across the country. And it's not like a cut or a bruise or a scrape. I think the most painful things I've ever experienced are moments when the person who I believed I was didn't line up with the person that I was being in the world.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us today. Native Lights is a podcast and radio show, but it's a lot more than that at its core. It's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musician, artists, community leaders, doctors, you name it. They have a wonderful mixture of passions. So we talk to them about their gifts and how they share their gifts with the community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. So let's get rocking. Leah, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you? Are you getting out and enjoying the great outdoors?
Oh, you betcha. You betcha, Leah. We were unable to see each other this weekend, but we both enjoyed the Hinckley powwow. You were there Saturday. I was there Sunday. That was really nice. It was the first time for Artem, our son, to hear the drum and all that good stuff. So we were excited for him. He was loving it.
Yeah, I got a bit of a tan. Just my forehead was pretty sunny.
Maria got sun-kissed on her forehead as well. She was annoyed about it. So we were all worried about, you know, getting him all sunscreened up, but we didn't even think about ourselves. But yeah, that was fun. That was fun seeing Dad up there in the MC stand.
That's right. Doing his thing. Awesome. Well, how do you stay active in the summer? Tell me.
Funny you should ask, Leah.
Yes, thank you.
I've been going on long walks with the boy to kind of clear my head. I try to go longer and longer every time. And I'm actually looking into a bike trailer here soon so I can tow him along.
Oh.
And so I'm in the research phase of that right now. How about you, Leah?
Out in the garden, watering the plants, chasing around the dog. I wish I was into cycling. Used to do it a bunch in Boston when I lived out there, but I haven't done it so much nowadays. But gosh, it looks fast and fun and swift.
It's a perfect segue into our episode, isn't it?
The perfect segue. Yeah. Why don't you bring us in?
Yes. Today, we're very excited to speak with Alexandra Houchin. Alexandra is a citizen of the Fond du Lac Nation of the Lake Superior Ojibwe. She resides in her reservation community in northern Minnesota. She's an ultra racer, bike packer, fixed gear bike enthusiast, outdoor adventurer, storyteller, and writer. And she is currently working on her memoir for Penguin Random House. So we're very excited to speak with her. Bonjour, Alexandra. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Sure.
All right, bonjour, Alexandra. Could you start off by introducing yourself and just, you know, letting us know where you're joining us from, you know, a little quick little background, that good stuff.
Totally. Buju anin indinwe mi konidog nenukasi guaniyashikwe indigu. Alexandra Houchin is my English name. My Ojibwe name is nenukasi guaniyashikwe, or Kasi for short. And I am a citizen over at Fond du Lac, and I guess I identify as a cyclist and a writer. Those are the two hats that at least fit right now.
Well, we usually like to start off these conversations by asking our guests if there's anything that you're thinking about, nerding out about, or anything that's just on the top of your mind.
I'm writing a book.
Oh.
So yeah, so storytelling in my life now shows up. We're working on a documentary film about, you know, my life story told through the lens of the racing that I did. And that project, you know, we had a little trailer for it and we were trying to like spread the word and see if we could find an investor, which took about a year of like asking literally anyone if they knew anybody who wanted to invest in a movie about a Native woman. It's just like not really the climate for it right now. So
okay,
it was really difficult to find somebody, but we did. And through that process of putting the trailer out there, we were contacted by an editor with Penguin Random House. And he was a fan and he was like, you know, if Alexandra wants to write a book, I'd love to work with her. I was like, literally a life dream. So, you know, a week after they connected with the director and producer of the film, I was connected with a fella named Andrew, who's an editor with Penguin Random House. And he was like, I've been reading your stuff for years. He's an avid cyclist and lives in Minneapolis. But he's like, I know who you are. I've been following you for years. I think you're an exceptional writer. If you're interested in writing a book, I think now is the time to do it. And I was pretty stoked to get that opportunity. So Penguin Random House offered me an advance, and that allowed me to, for the first time in a lot of years, not pursue any sponsorships, which is a huge relief, because that, now that I'm distance from that world, I really don't fit in the influencer sponsorship realm. So I'm stoked to not be doing that anymore. I started writing on January 9th. So right now it's like my full time. That's like the only real work I have on my calendar. I was working some other contract work before. I have some contract work ramping up right now. So for the past few months, I've been maybe too much in it, and then spent a lot of time reading. I mean, I'm still reading, and more than maybe I ever have in my adult life. Reading any memoir I can get my hands on. You know, I started, at first I was like, I'm going to read all the Native memoirs I can read. So I pounded through a ton of Native memoirs first, and then just kind of memoirs in general. And some young adult storytelling, because the memoir is a young adult memoir. Girls, mostly, or like that's the main audience I'm writing for. I'm writing to like my past self is the lens I'm trying to write through. But, oh, it's really difficult. You know, I've written like 5,000 and 10,000 word pieces, but like never a cohesive book. And kind of teetering between this line of like, okay, I like to be exceptional. Ideally, I could be exceptional at everything that I do. Realistically, that's not the case. So I'm toying with this like imposter syndrome of like, I want to write a really impactful book that people can read and see themselves in and connect with. And, you know, my dreams would come true if one person who read the book decided to change their life.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Alexandra Houchin. Alexandra is a citizen of the Fond du Lac Nation of Lake Superior Ojibwe. She's an ultra racer, bike packer, fixed gear bike enthusiast, outdoor adventurer, storyteller, and writer. Let's dive into the book a little bit more. What do you plan to provide the reader with? What are you looking for with this book?
Yeah, so the editor that contacted me is a children's editor, and he asked me if I wanted to write a young adult memoir, to which I said, hell yeah. The book is, I kind of got to pick who and what I am writing it for, and I'm writing it for, you know, 12 to 19, 12 to 22-year-old Native women, because growing up, I had never heard a story like mine. And a lot of my insecurity came from feeling like I wasn't Native enough as a young girl, because I have what I thought at the time was a really non-traditional Indian story. But as I got older and kind of pieced together a lot of the puzzle, I learned that my story was a very Native story, and I want more people to have access to more Native stories. So, you know, my goal with the book is to be just one more Native person telling one more Native story in the sea of all the amazing Native authors that are out there. I've structured it in a pretty cool way, I think, of having these partner essays where I introduce this idea of a significant life event, something that was really formative and shaped me as a person, and then having a contrasting partner essay where I process some of that trauma or some of the lived story through the lens of competing in ultra endurance events. A lot of the space that ultra endurance events has cultivated for me is one of healing and ceremony and processing. So I definitely would not be where I am today without having this space through moving my body over vast landscapes over days. You get a lot of time to think.
Let me know if I'm connecting the dots in an incorrect manner, but I read a decent amount about your background where you would join these ultra races and you wouldn't see anybody who looked like you, not a whole lot of Native representation. I saw that you wrote in one of your bios or one of the, that you envisioned a world where you'd see more Natives in that space. Is this book, you know, for young adults kind of pushing towards that goal, making it more of a common thing, or just sharing your story and hoping to inspire more people? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. I think I'm basically writing to a younger me. It's the only experience I can really, truly, completely understand. And just thinking about, you know, times are definitely a little bit different now. The access to information into different narratives and stories and seeing people who look more like you is a little bit easier because of social media. But when I was growing up, I just didn't have any Native people around me. Like, my mom was adopted in the 1970s off the reservation by a non-Native couple. And she grew up, she had a really hard, really rough life and super disconnected from her culture. Despite the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, being enacted, that was supposed to work retroactively to allow her to identify her tribal affiliation, she kept coming up against hurdles where her birth certificates, et cetera, all the information was redacted. So it took her, I think I got enrolled when I was 19, and she said she started looking for her birth family when she was pregnant with me. So it took her about 20 years to find her biological parents. So all that to say is, like, we grew up really estranged from our tribal community, and further, any Native people, we really didn't spend any time in the company of Natives. So really just writing to that younger version of me and really holding on to the fact that no matter what it is that I do and no matter how I do it, it's always going to be in a Native way, just because, you know, I am Native no matter what. The chapter that I'm working on right now really has to do a lot with the dueling scarcity / abundance mindset in relationship to my understanding of how to connect with other women. I grew up a lot in the 90s and early 2000s, and I feel like the media really had a big impact on me of, like, comparing women, People magazines, like, who wore it better, who's dressed best, like, all of that kind of crap really put me in this lens of a scarcity mindset of having this career in a male-dominated world. And I had done some welding and tool and die and machining before this, while also having worked in bikes. So most of my work has been in male-dominated worlds, and I was usually always the only girl around and realizing that a lot of those formative girl relationships that I had as a younger person, those early relationships really formed how I related to and treated women in my 20s and now in my 30s, of being less insecure and realizing that it's not a scarcity world just because one other person succeeds or beats me or whatnot. Doesn't really mean that she's better than me or I'm better than her. It's just that we both, you know, can learn and grow from each other. So right now I'm really exploring that idea of like, I'm enough, because younger me never felt enough. I always compared myself to other women and girls, and it was really detrimental to my emotional well-being.
That is so powerful and so true. I know, like, having social media now and having this look back as like, hey, this is what we were experiencing, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s with, like you said, you know, pitting celebrities against each other, who's what size, like it was out of control. And
totally.
Did we realize it at the time? I don't know.
I think it was subconscious, you know, just like it's boiled into your brain.
Mm-hmm. I felt like I was just nodding along like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, she totally did wear a vest.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you're the expert, right?
Yeah, right.
So yeah, that is great and definitely needed. And I could definitely see a young Leah needing a story like that too, or a memoir like that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really wonderful. You can work on bikes, I take it. Like you get oily and dirty and all that stuff.
Yeah, I have been out of bike shops for maybe 5 years now. But I think I worked in bike shops for 10 or 12 years in various roles, sales, mechanic. I really do like working on bikes. I really got started in the urban commuting / like delivery, you know, doing it for work in that capacity. I moved to Arizona for my undergrad in 2016. I was an older student, but yeah, moved to Arizona after I did this ride called the Tour Divide in 2015. And I rode from Mexico to Canada over a summer, and it kind of changed my life. So moved to Tucson and then got into mountain biking there. I'd done a handful of bike tours in the years before that locally. You know, my very first bike tour was I rode from Madison all the way up to the reservation up here in Cloquet. And that was like a 400-mile, I think I did it over 10 days or something, bike tour. Just kind of, you know, it's so fun to look back on now as like, oh, it was actually very symbolic. My very first bike tour was kind of this quest to go to the reservation and find out more about who I was and who my mom was and what our relationship was, and really asking, like, what kind of life do I want to live and who do I want to be in this world? And it was like leaving my old behind, coming towards a new. And, you know, now that I live here, now that I've been here for so long, like, oh, I didn't really know that that was like the start of really the rest of my life.
Cool.
So you're also in the midst of getting funding working on funding for a documentary that you guys have worked on. Could you talk more about the documentary and, you know, when you plan to release it or hope to release it?
Well, the world of making documentary films is not very straightforward to me and has kind of been this really long, long-winded path, I guess, to get to where we are today. In 2018, I won the Tour Divide. It was this, you know, that tour that I went on. It was a 2,700-mile bike race across the country. And I won the women's race, totally unsuspecting. I had no idea that I had that in me. I just was trying to do the thing as fast as I could. And at that time, when I started writing about cycling, There just weren't really a ton of people writing like the way that I was writing. And from my perspective, I'm like a pretty non-traditional person in the sport of cycling in general. And really started writing about my experience, that inner dialogue stuff, about the hard things, the things that I was scared of, just like the self-doubt, and just kind of this like fully authentic way. Well, then I went back to win the Tour Divide again in 2019, which kind of blew my mind. But in that, I had gotten so many more opportunities from sponsors, from journalists, from filmmakers. So many people were like, hey, we want to make a movie about you. Hey, we want to do a thing about you. Just because, you know, it was a non-traditional story. I was totally the underdog, totally surprised myself by winning. It was this kind of crazy, wild experience. And in 2019, I had been approached by a friend of a friend who was a filmmaker. And he was like, let's make a documentary about your life. And I was like, okay, let's do it. This was kind of like as I was coming up in my cycling career, as I started collecting wins and records under my belt. And we started kind of grassroots filming. He was just a solo guy. This was a passion project. And he, like, you know, slept on my couch. We did a bunch of interviews. And then nothing really happened with that. So we have a bunch of footage from that. Fast forward to, I think it was 2021. I was an alternate. I was the backup for this Red Bull project. And one of the women who was invited ended up backing out. And I got like a last minute opportunity to go. That was when I was working for the Fond du Lac band for one of my fellowships. And I remember talking to my superior and being like, I kind of feel like if I don't go on this trip, I'm missing the opportunity of a lifetime. Got the 2 weeks off, flew to Idaho to do this Red Bull project with an acquaintance. Well, on that bike trip, I met this guy named Corey Rich, and he is a photographer and filmmaker with really heavy connections to the film world. And I totally got bamboozled into a phone call with him. And he's like, hey, if you ever want to make a documentary about your life, we're interested and we'd love to do that. And I was like, okay, cool. So many people had asked me and I just really wasn't interested in making a film about myself. Well, it turned out that later that year in 2021, I decided that I was going to take a chance and go all in on the sponsor world and left all of my other employment and went full time into athlete world. And I called this guy and I was like, hey, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to be a professional athlete. And in 2023, I'm going to do this race series, this 4,500 mile race series. Let's make a movie. I had finally acquired a sponsor. I got sponsored in a meaningful way by the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and it was my first real big pro contract, and I got to race bikes. Let's make a documentary about how you went all in on this season of racing, and we're sponsored by an Indian nation. He was all on board. And in 2023, they filmed my experience around the Triple Crown Challenge, which is three of the United States' most, three of the United States' oldest and most significant bike packing races. And I set out to try and get the overall single speed record for the race series, which I did not get. I did set a new women's record, but I fell short of the overall record. and we filmed that story, and we're hoping to tell bits of my life story through the lens of those races.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Alexandra Houchin, citizen of the Fond du Lac Band. She's a professional mountain bike athlete and is currently writing her memoir.
What gives you fuel to keep going? You're doing a memoir, you did this documentary, you're doing these daunting races. What gives you fuel to keep going?
You know, it's really interesting. My boyfriend recently was talking to me and just recognizing that my Anishinaabe name is Nenukasi Guaniashikwe. And like, if you think about the hummingbird, it's like, you know, just like bouncing all over the place, like doing 8 million things. And there's a lot of really special stories associated with the hummingbird too. And I kind of think some of that like is on the spirit level of just like who I am and like what wavelength I exist on. It's kind of this like, go, 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 try to do as many impossible things as you can conjure up. So there's a little bit of that, but then there's also just like, there's this idea that I've been weaving into the book that I'm working on, that I think some of the hardest and most painful things that I've ever experienced are not like the ardor of competing day after day, or they're not like the fatigue that builds up over 20 days racing across the country. And it's not like a cut or a bruise or a scrape. I think the most painful things I've ever experienced are moments when the person who I believed I was didn't line up with the person that I was being in the world. And being able to recognize that dissonance within myself has fueled me through a lot of really, really hard times of weakness. So, you know, like when I'm out there competing and I want to quit, I think about the way I visualized how the race was going to go and what the outcome was going to be. And most of the time, the race never, ever ends up, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to win. I'm going to go so fast. I'm going to set all the records and all the history of being the fastest person ever alive. That has never happened. That will never happen. But being able to be present, be in the experience, and just remembering that at least I'm trying to be that person. At least I'm trying to be the best version of myself. And that is better than being somebody I don't even know who I am. So.
Wow. Alexandra Houchin, cyclist, bike packer, memoirist, writer. Just so lovely to hear her talk about her experience.
My legs hurt just even thinking about it all. Thousands of miles, and you know, tell she's got a lot of resolve, and I'm glad she's going to be bringing some of that inspiration to young readers. So miigwech to our guest, Alexandra Houchin. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Thanks for tuning in this weekend to People Powered KEXE. I'm Heidi Holton. You are welcome here. You are always welcome here to tell us about what you're seeing in nature. Up next is the Season Watch podcast, where we're featuring John Latimer's weekly phenology report. And it is a way for us to kind of sit together, maybe drink some coffee or, you know, a nice big glass of juice or apple cider, and just start thinking a little bit more about what's going on in the world. John's going to be talking about things like wild bergamot that are an oasis for the butterflies and the hummingbirds. The the things that are blooming right now, goldenrod, the berries. I know I was able to pick some blueberries this week, and we'd love to hear from you. It's a easy thing to do. You can text 218-326-1234. We also want to hear from you that programming like this matters. Season Watch, that ties you to this place. You might be in northern Minnesota. Maybe it's your second home. Maybe it's a getaway you have a couple times a year. Maybe you've been coming for generations. But if KXE is a part of your time up north, we need you to help us keep going with support right now. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Whether it's $1,000 or $100, we need you. Do your part. Let's take a listen to John Batiste and then John Latimer on this edition of Season Watch.
You can buy a house, but you can't buy a home. You can be surrounded and still be alone. Life, but not living the dream. Mama said, boy, don't you be no dummy. Everybody chasing that big, big money.
Big money!
You might have got a horse, don't mean you can ride on a horse. You might have got a plane, but that don't make you fly. Not living the dream, it seems. Grandmama said, boy, don't be a dummy. Everybody chasing that big, big money.
Big money!
Now, might as well live for something you can feel. Might as well live for something real. Now, might as well live for something. You can buy a song, don't mean you can sing. And you can win it all and still lose everything.
When you tune into KEXE, you'll hear our phenology students reminding us to pay attention to nature.
Hello from Mr. Masakovic's class at Baxter Elementary School. This past week brought our first substantial rainfall on one day.
Canadian thistle has popped up.
Greetings from the fourth grade phenology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Eliza,
Charlie, and Mary
reporting on our observations for the week ending May 1st.
This week, we observed our lilac have many sets of leaves on it.
Hi, this is Carson.
And Reese from Crooked Lake Elementary School in Andover, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center for April 29th through May 1st. The weather was sunny but cool with a high temperature of 48 degrees Fahrenheit. And
this concludes the phenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
KEXE celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio.
It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And I'm going to give you a list of all of the plants that I have found in flower over the last week. And I'm going to also list off a bunch of plants that are in fruit or approaching fruit. I'll talk a little bit about some bald eagles and a black bear. It's going to be a
interesting morning. But to get you started, as I look out of the studio today, well, first of all, my wife remarked to me the other day, my wild bergamot is in flower. And that was last week, Tuesday or Wednesday. And I look out of the studios today and the entire rain garden below the studio here is fringed with wild bergamot. And it is absolutely beautiful and a welcome oasis for a lot of butterflies and hummingbirds. They all like those deep tubular flowers that have a little prize way at the back, a little nectar deep inside. So wild bergamot is blooming. It is pale. I would call it pink, but I'm sure my wife would have another color for it. It's got a little bit of blue in it. So it's kind of on the order of, say, Canada thistle in terms of its color. Pink with a little bit of blue tinge. So, and by the way, Canada thistle is in bloom. Canada thistle and bull thistle, the two common thistles in northern Minnesota. Canada thistle has no spines, no pickers on the stems. The stems are clear and clean. You can handle a Canada thistle by the stem. A bull thistle, the stem is as prickly as the leaves are, and you will want to avoid any contact with a bull thistle. Bull thistle's a little redder than the Canada thistle, and the bull thistle's flower is a little bit bigger than the Canada thistle. They're interesting because I once pulled up to a mailbox, and there's a big patch of bull thistle right there by the mailbox, and sitting on one of the flower heads was a butterfly, and for the life of me right now, I can't recall the species. It might have been a monarch. It might have been one of the fritillaries. It was orange and black, as I do recall. But a bumblebee came flying in and was like, you know what? I'm going to have some of that nectar as well. And the butterfly sitting on the flower let the butterfly get quite close and then just flapped its wing out and slapped the butterfly right in the face. And slapped the bumblebee right in the face. And the bumblebee veered off and went to a different flower. So they may have stingers, but, you know, the butterflies have some defenses as well, including those big wings. Goldenrod, the flat-topped goldenrod, sometimes called grass-leaved because it's got a very narrow leaf. Tall goldenrod and Canada goldenrod are all flowering. I'm not sure between tall and Canada which is which. And I went, speaking of rabbit holes, I went down, I pulled one up that had been run over along the trail and was laying down, and I pulled the plant up and brought it in the house, and I spent about an hour digging through Minnesota Wildflowers and some other texts to try and figure out whether I had tall goldenrod or Canada goldenrod. And by the time I got done, I sort of put together this little paragraph of my thoughts, and it was tall goldenrod and Canada goldenrod get mixed up constantly, and even botanists will argue about it in the field. The clearest tell is the leaves. Tall goldenrod has leaves that are noticeably rough and hairy on both surfaces, almost sandpapery to the touch, with one obvious vein running down the middle. Canada goldenrod's leaves are smoother on top, hairy mainly underneath, and show three prominent veins instead of one. Tall goldenrod also tends to have a grayer, more pubescent stem, while Canada goldenrod's stem is greener and less fuzzy. Both form the classic pyramidal, one-sided plume of yellow flowers arcing over the top, and both spread aggressively by rhizomes to form big colonies. So habitat alone won't separate them. If you got the plant in hand, running your fingers over the leaf surface is probably your fastest field test. Now, you tall goldenrod and Canada goldenrod, they're awfully tough to separate, but the tall goldenrod has that rougher, sandpapery kind of leaf. Canada goldenrod is blooming at my house right now, but tall goldenrod is yet to bloom. Another thing, tall goldenrod has hairy, and I have to be very careful here, tall goldenrod has hairy galls. Canada goldenrod does not have galls at all. Giant goldenrod has smooth galls. So if you have galls present, look at them. And the hairs on the tall goldenrod galls are going to be very small, very, very, almost not noticeable, but they are there. And giant goldenrod will have no hair whatsoever on the gall. And Canada goldenrod has no galls. So if it has galls, it's either tall or giant. If it has no gall, it could be any one of the three. But it also has a likelihood of being Canada goldenrod. Check the leaf. Also flowering, tall sunflower, Gigantea. I did a lot of work with that one as well, trying to make sure that I had it ID'd properly, and it took another half hour of looking. Again, I pulled up a plant and brought it in the house, and I looked at the bracts, and I looked at the structure of the stem and the leaves, and oh my, there's just so many things, and some of these flowers are so closely related that it's really quite difficult. So goldenrod and sunflower, two definitely difficult ones to identify. Besides those, a common skullcap or marsh skullcap is blooming. This is a sort of a tubular flower. It's usually done in twos. The leaves are opposite. There is another skullcap called the monk's skullcap? Mad dog skullcap. Mad dog skullcap tends to be lighter, slightly pinkish looking, and has a white throat on the petal that forms the bottom of the flower is white. In the case of the marsh or common skullcap, the flower is deeper blue. And like I said, they'll be in twins and the leaves are opposite, but skullcap. Also, boneset and Joe pieweed are both blooming, and they are both eupatorium. And that is refers to sheep or wool, because the flowers are kind of woolly looking on both boneset, which is white, and Joe pieweed, which is purple or reddish. Northern bedstraw is blooming, and it has tiny dots of white flowers, lots and lots of them. Think of like the flower on a dill, except make it white instead of yellow, and you'll have an idea of what the flowers are like on the bedstraw. The easiest way to recognize bedstraw is if you see a plant kind of 1 to 2 feet high, sort of climbing on other plants, reach down and grab it. And if it grabs back, that's bedstraw. Bulb-bearing water hemlock is blooming at my house. This one is not to be confused with the actual water hemlock. Water hemlock, Cicuta maculata, is poisonous, very poisonous. Bulb-bearing water hemlock is not. But why take a chance? Bulb-bearing water hemlock has leaves again. Think of the dill. Bulb-bearing water hemlock has really, really tiny leaves like the leaves on a dill plant. The poisonous water hemlock has a leaf, not exactly like the leaf of marijuana, but the leaves are in threes. They are long and narrow and toothed, and so they are the leaves of the two plants are markedly different. Flat-topped aster has begun to bloom. I found my first flowers on the flat-topped asters. This is about average. I think they were 2 or 3 days early. white flowers and flat top. So all of the flowers are going to be sort of at one level on the flat-topped aster. The large-leafed aster is also blooming. The large-leafed aster is the, in the springtime, you see these big, big green leaves in the forest on the ground, and that's the beginnings of the large-leafed aster. Some of those leaves will continue to send up a stalk, and the stalk will have leaves on it that are also quite large. And at the top of that stalk will be a flower head, and you'll have these blue flowers that are about an inch across. And they have, it's a ray flower, like a daisy, except imagine that somebody went in there and plucked a few of the rays out. So you'll have two or three rays and a gap, and then maybe three or four rays and then a gap, and then maybe two rays and a gap. So it looks like somebody has come along and just randomly plucked out some of the rays on the large-leafed aster flowers, light blue and just beginning to bloom right now. Marsh bellflower is blooming. If you're in the swamps, this plant is very spindly. It has white flowers that are about a half inch across, maybe a half inch deep. They're bell-shaped, and they are white, and that is marsh bellflower. Meadow sweet is probably at its peak of bloom. Black bindweed is at its peak of bloom. The black bindweed has a bright red stem, kind of shield-shaped or arrowhead-shaped leaves, and it has very, very tiny white flowers, but it is really blooming right now. Pearly everlasting is blooming. Fireweed is about its peak of bloom. And spreading dogbane has begun to put out seed pods, but it is still one of the predominant white flowers that you'll see out there. Among the plants that are fruiting or about to fruit, black chokeberry has green berries on it. I have a domestic varietal in my yard that doesn't have a very big crop of berries this year. Last year it had a huge crop. My native black chokeberry is doing fine and looks to have a fairly respectable crop of berries coming. Nannyberry is freighted, just loaded with berries, and they are as green as can be. Bunch berries are bright red right now. Pin cherries are ripe and red. Choke cherries are taking a blush, but not yet ripe. There are lots of hazelnuts out there, at least at my house. The beaked and the American hazels have a pretty bountiful crop of nuts coming along. Milkweed pods are out. I mentioned the spreading dogbane has its flower or its seed pods, 3-inch long, 1/8-inch wide green seed pods on the dogbane. Blue bead lily, the berries on the blue bead lily are bright blue right now. And if you're driving along this morning and you see these dark, like coffee brown plants that look like these long tubes that are standing up along the edge of the road, that's a plant called curled dock. And what you're seeing there are the ever-ripening seeds of the curled dock. As I mentioned, I saw a bear this week. In fact, night before last, came into the yard just about sundown and was looking for a little bite to eat. Unfortunately, it ran into me and my dog, and we ran it off, and then we took away all the food. And we're hoping that that's that for that bear. We'll see. That's the Phenology Show for this week. As always, if you have contributions that you'd like to make, comments or observations you'd like to share, we'd like to hear from you. And we'd especially like to hear from you. Give us a call. Let us know you're listening. Let us know you appreciate the program.
It's easy to become a member. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. That donation means that you care about programming that is independent, that features the voices of kids who are learning about nature, who are curious and are teaching us to be curious as well. Whether you can give $1,000 or maybe you can do $100, be a part of this. Keep programming like Phenology, like Season Watch, going strong. Go to KAXE.org. Here's the reports that came in this week.
Well, you know, it is our custom on Tuesday mornings to bring you talkbacks, And during the school year, many of them are generated by students. During the summer, some are generated by students and some are generated just by folks who are out doing a little phenology in their own backyards. And regardless of where you are, what happens at your house is your phenology. What happens at my house, you know, this week, I noticed that between me and all of the birds, there are no June berries left in our neighborhood. So that's just my house. Maybe you still have some June berries that you're enjoying. I enjoyed my last ones last week, and I haven't had any since. And I was out for a long walk yesterday, and I was not able to find any more. So wherever you are, your phenology is special, and I hope that you will take the time to send us a little note. Maybe you can call in this morning and pledge your support and leave us a little phenology note as well. But to our end, our first generated report this morning comes from a school, and it is Leona Sitchie's class at Roots and Wings Forest School in New York Mills.
This is the Adventures from Roots Wings Forest School, reporting from Glendale State Park, July 22nd. I saw a baby red squirrel climbing on a tree.
I saw popcorn beam seeds, and they're laying on the ground. Last week, they were on the tree.
I seen a deer track. I saw a bunch of sunnies, and I threw sticks in, and they thought it was bugs, and they went to it.
Basswood trees lost their flowers, and what was left behind was the hard nutlet.
I saw crystals in the sand.
I saw a wolf spider on the ground, and the colors were brown and black.
Was it a big spider or a little spider?
It was a little spider. It was about the size of my thumb.
I saw a sand wasp digging in the sand. It was like pale.
So
it seemed more white than yellow.
I saw a great blue heron and a white-throated sparrow. And the white-throated sparrow kind of, its whistle sounded kind of like a human.
Thanks for listening. Stay wild.
Stay wild indeed. All of those great observations. Baby squirrels, hop hornbeam, also known as ironwood, and the seeds on hop hornbeam, and this may be the reason for the name hop hornbeam. The wood itself is very hard, but the seed is a chevron-like structure that looks a lot like the hop flower. And they are definitely, as they said, last week they were on the trees and this week they're on the ground. That's what happens, and that's where seeds want to be. I saw a bunch of sunnies. I threw sticks, and they thought they were food, and they went to it. That's a pretty good observation. Basswood trees, the flowering is done, and what remains are these very hard nutlets. Wolf spider on the ground, brown and black. A little spider, about the size of her thumb. And someone else saw a sand wasp digging in the sand. And that's pretty amazing, because I actually watched that happen once myself. The wasp flew along, found a spider, landed, stung the spider into a torpor, into a coma, and then dragged the spider over and buried it in the dirt in the sand after placing an egg inside of it. And the spider is not dead. It's simply paralyzed. And when the egg hatches, it will consume the spider and then emerge as another sand wasp. So, interesting little story there, and the kids got a chance to see the start of it. Great blue herons, white-throated sparrows, and yeah, I'd say the white-throated sparrow does have a song that sort of sounds like a human whistling. And it's kind of cool, you know, the fact that they can make that beautiful song and make it so clear. It's such a nice, clear tone. That's what our talkback segment's all about. Mm-hmm. Those are students those are young students, but it doesn't matter the student's age. They all perceive the world at a different level, perhaps. Maybe a ninth grader would have seen it a little differently, but would have seen the same things. Whether they came up with those same interpretations, we won't know. But that's what we do.
And we're noticing. We don't have to know everything. We can ask other people, like, what is this? I mean, think about Tuesday mornings. We get all these texts in from people telling us what they're seeing, sending a photo. I show it to John, and we try to figure out what it is. You know that you feel like you're a part of this because you are. This is independent public radio. This is KEXE. We're the oldest rural public radio station in the nation, and we are determined to keep on going. Even, you know, 50 years in, we are going into the future because we think this matters. We think that people's voices and being able to contribute like this makes a huge difference. So help us out. Do your part. 218-326-1234. You can text the word donate to that number as well.
We have another report here that comes from the 4-H summer camp at Long Lake Conservation Center in Palisade.
Hi, this is Reagan.
And Irene. From 4-H Summer Camp at Long Lake Conservation Center, July 21st through the 24th. The temps for Camp Week were a pleasant high of 81 degrees Fahrenheit and a low of 43 degrees. A new crop of wildflowers are blooming, including Pearly Everlasting, the first goldenrods, milkweed, tansy bee balm. We also enjoy munching on ripe wild raspberry. A colony of 30 or so little brown bats were spotted at night. A lot of them were small and could be pups. Three pretty large bucks were spotted together with velvet-covered antlers.
We noticed that the stress caused by the hot and dry conditions has caused some trees to start losing their leaves. In lake bottom organisms class, we found leeches, baby crayfish, and a variety of water bugs. A large number of leopard frogs were seen onshore. On the lake, the common loons have been busy fishing and were singing at night. A report from the beehives is that lots of honey is being made, thanks in part to the blooming basswood trees, a favorite of the worker bees. We had a great week of camp, and we want to remind everyone to unplug, get outside, and live connected!
You've been listening to Season Watch here on People Powered KAXE. Reports from students, from campers across our region, letting us know what they are seeing. Whether you're at camp and you are recording a message for us, or you're sending in a text, like we heard from Tim from Maple Grove this week, who was sending us a photo of what he thought was a bullfrog. We showed it to John Latimer, and he said, nope, it's a green frog. If you're hearing the sound of an untuned banjo string, that is the sound of the green frog, like just like Kermit the Frog. Do your part right now to support this kind of programming. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Here we are with the sound of the green frog.
As KAXE celebrates 50 years, we thank the many voices who have filled the airwaves in northern Minnesota.
Welcome to Back Porch Harmony. I'm Joan Downham, playing the tunes tonight.
Of all the wild gatherers, the mapler seems the most optimistic.
The sauna logs, so obvious to a woodworker's discerning eye, were hand-hewn.
So this next set's going to do a few of his train songs. We're going to start out with one of his early ones, called Blue Train.
I'm Jennifer Barr, and that was Joan Downham, Gil Quall, Terry O'Brien, and the Doctor of Togo Musicology. These voices were part of our past, and you can help build the future of KAXE with your voice and support. Give now at KAXE.org.